Chapter 9. The Next Generation, The Harvard Experiment. On a chilly November day, I traveled to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to the hushed campus of Harvard Business School. Passing by empty tennis courts, I found my way to the Spangler Student Center. I was here to meet with members of a new men's student group called, unironically, the Manbassadors. The name is hilarious, but the goal couldn't be more earnest: to support gender equity at work and at home. By now, I had watched as symphony orchestras, companies, even entire countries, experimented with every way imaginable to narrow the gender gap. Blind auditions, bias training, quotas. There seemed to be nothing they hadn't attempted. And yet the gap still stubbornly yawns between us. The problem, as was becoming increasingly clear, is that by the time most of us reach the workplace, it's already too late. Bias is established long before we ever get our first jobs. That's what brought me to Harvard. The school had posed an intriguing question: what would happen if you tried to start the clock earlier, to eliminate biases before letting students loose in the world? In search of a solution, the school had launched one of the most ambitious experiments yet in social engineering. In 2013, writer Jody Cantor chronicled the beginning of this grand plan in the New York Times. Several years earlier, Harvard Business School had upended its curriculum, changing courses and requirements with an audacious goal: to create an environment that would eliminate gender bias and encourage success for its female graduates and its female faculty. The experiment meant blowing up an ingrained social and academic culture. Class participation counted for 50% of grades, yet discussions were typically dominated by men. At night, to blow off steam, some of the men played a drinking game, rating female classmates on a scale of F, marry, or kill. To change things up, Harvard installed note takers in class, in part so that professors wouldn't forget when a woman had spoken up. It introduced a new course called Field that required group problem solving rather than focusing on individual contributions, which often seemed to favor men. Students got coaching on how to raise their hands to make sure that women and introverted male students didn't get lost in the crowd. Harvard worked as well with female faculty, who were far less likely than their male peers to get tenure. The experiment succeeded in some ways. Women participated more in class and won more academic awards than before. But by one important measure, it failed. Some of the men rebelled. One described it in the Times as patronizing, echoing the older male executives I had met who bristled at diversity training. Some students complained that the gender message was shoved down our throats. I was curious, though, about what had happened since. Was the experiment ultimately a success? Would the lessons the school taught its students stick with them in the workplace, or would they be forgotten? In short, could early intervention, exposing students to a meticulously designed curriculum intended to even the playing field, pay off for everyone? Young men have played an outsized role in the misogynistic bro cultures of Silicon Valley and Wall Street. Yet there's also ample evidence that on the whole, their generation of millennials has a more equitable view of the world than that of their elders. Millennial men between the ages of 18 and 35 are more likely than those in other generations to favor an egalitarian relationship between husbands and wives. What's more, when Deloitte asked millennials of both genders what qualities were most important in a career, the top choice was good work-life balance, outranking more conventional aspirations like opportunities for promotion, leadership, and even deriving meaning from work. In part, this is because the men, largely children of working mothers, have a different perspective than that of their fathers and grandfathers before them. In part, it's because the women raised on "you go girl" huzzas won't put up with it any other way. And perhaps most of all, it's because of the 24/7 work culture that has burned out men and women alike. Seeing how their parents work, attached to their devices and at the beck and call of their offices, young adults are saying enough. I've noticed the phenomenon myself. Years ago, when one of my colleagues took paternity leave, our coworkers were astonished and skeptical. They were pretty sure he was just goofing off or maybe stealthily looking for another job. Back then, when I interviewed men for job openings, they never talked about wives or children. The topic simply didn't come up. Fast forward to now, and virtually every young father I interview for openings stresses the importance of family time. Almost all tell me they need to discuss a potential new position with their wives. Ironic, considering that few women these days would dare suggest they need to check about a job with their husbands. Nor do the female job candidates I meet explain the intricacies of how they split childcare with their spouses, as the young fathers I interview often do. It's the men, not the women, who ask if they will have the flexibility to spend time with their children, to coach soccer, to occasionally work at home. For the men, it's a point of pride. For the women, it's still considered a sign of weakness. That attitude is even stronger for the youngest adult men, those 18 to 25. They overwhelmingly disagree with the notion that men should be the breadwinner and women should take care of the home. This isn't just a Harvard phenomenon, nor is it one that is unique to business schools or to highly educated men. It signals a generational shift among men from every walk of life that may well have a profound influence on gender relations going forward. To see how it's playing out, and to get a sense of whether those attitudes will stick, I hurried up the stairs to a second-floor conference room to meet with the Manbassador leaders. As the group's stated mission, to engage men in a productive, ongoing conversation about gender issues, suggests, on the whole, Harvard Business School, HBS, students are a self-serious lot. Professors in the school's own website state unequivocally that their goal is to create future global leaders. "Our mission is to educate leaders who will make a difference in the world," one of the deans told me. "The school's definition of leadership is about making others better as a result of your presence, and having it last after your absence." Several students described a social life that is as intense as any of their studies. Romance is calculated, with an almost artisanal obsession for detail. By date three, they had to decide whether this was their life partner or not, one recent male grad explained. "It's the type of personality drawn to HBS. The students approach their clubs just as purposefully. Each class, of about 900, is broken into 10 sections, and in each section, those students vie to become representatives of various clubs, including the Manbassadors." The group's origin dates back to a conversation between two friends. In 2013, then-student Tara Hagen noticed that the men on campus sometimes had trouble relating to their female classmates. Women are still a minority at business schools. They made up just 41% of HBS students in 2016, and that figure itself was a historic high. Hagen was particularly struck by a comment made by one of her close male friends. "If you're a man, you've never talked about gender before," he had told her. "But what is my role? What am I supposed to contribute? I don't know what to say. I'm afraid of being politically incorrect." Hagen realized that, while HBS may attract students with great test scores and enormous ambition, the men here were in one respect no different than men anywhere else. They were scared out of their wits to talk about gender. From that revelation came the spark of an idea: create a club affiliated with the women's student group, but made up of men. It was a eureka moment. Still, even Hagen, who became one of its founders, was uncertain the idea would work. "I was scared," she acknowledges. "I was afraid people would think it was lame." She needn't have worried. The day of the school's club sign-up fair, she arrived with nothing more than a laptop and a poster. By the time she left, 100 people had signed up. Not long afterward, 30 male students gathered in a classroom. One by one, they spoke up, going around the room to explain why they were there. One had watched as his mother struggled at work. Another saw that his sister didn't have the same opportunities as he did. It gave Hagen chills as she heard each classmate tell his tale. The Manbassadors had arrived. The club has gained considerable traction since then. These days, about 40% of HBS's male students join the Manbassadors, and the movement is spreading. In the last couple of years, similar men's groups have formed on other business school campuses, including at Wharton, Stanford, Columbia, UCLA, Duke, the University of Chicago, and the University of Michigan. The group hosts events like work-life balance conversations with prominent HBS graduates and their spouses. Its members identify themselves with tastefully understated gray Manbassadors t-shirts. The first version of the shirt was hot pink, emblazoned with Thomas Jefferson's quote, "Men of quality are not threatened by women of equality." But no one wore them, Hagen told me. That was a lesson, she said. Baby steps. Inside the conference room, I was greeted by one of the ambassador's co-chairs, Sam Travers. Soft-spoken and serious, wearing a maroon sweater over his plaid button-down shirt, Sam had worked at the Department of Defense before coming to Harvard. He was also among the minority of students who were married. His wife was in law school, and one of the issues the couple discussed frequently was how they would someday balance work and family. Before HBS, I wouldn't have thought to join a women's advocacy network at work, he told me. But the discussions with his wife, along with his previous job experience, where I was lucky to have female mentors and managers, made him more aware of the issues facing women. So coming to HBS, I was excited to see a community of men and women who can talk about these issues, about work-life balance. Sam is similar to many millennial men in that, like others in his generation, he expects to have an equal marriage with his wife and a balanced life for them both. Sam and other male students I met were confident that those ideals were within reach. At job interviews, Sam told me he always asked about paternity leave policies. His wife is told this information is part of the standard package for female applicants, he said, yet prospective employers were often surprised by his question. I've had people give me credit for asking, and they say, "Your wife must be proud of you." He couldn't figure out why there's such a double standard. There's no such thing as a man's or woman's issue. Everything is interconnected. Sitting beside Sam was another ambassador, Matt Simpson, fashionably bearded and sipping takeout coffee. Matt, like Sam, had a female boss before he entered business school and his post-collegiate job at a consulting firm. Through her, he learned issues I wasn't aware of, like pressures his boss felt to keep it all business. He was astonished that a woman who was that great a leader would feel pressure to act like a guy. It made him realize there's little things men don't pick up on, little subconscious behaviors like men are more likely to listen to another guy. Just being aware of it makes you more mindful. I was struck by how easily Sam and Matt spoke about gender, far more easily than most older men I knew. They weren't self-conscious or hesitant. They volunteered that they had become attuned to small slights, like women being interrupted in discussions. They talked about common sense actions they now took, like calling out when a woman's idea was attributed to a man. Unlike their elders, they didn't reflexively gag and turn ashen when the topic turned to gender. Here I've been able to help engage. It doesn't have to be a formal thing, as Matt put it. You can talk about it with your buddies having a beer. The men were certainly sincere, and yet as optimistic as they were about this new world, the truth is that neither HBS nor the business world it trains its students to conquer has caught up with them. That became clear when a female classmate joined the conversation. She noted that in one of her classes, the discussion revolved around making technology so simple your mom or sister or grandma could use it, while in another, hypothetical business leaders were described using male pronouns. The latter reflects an unfortunate reality. Only 9% of HBS case studies, the course material students read about real-life executives, focus on female leaders. That trend holds true across all top business schools. One analysis found that 90% of business school case studies are about men. Both Sam and Matt fully expected to become leaders as they went forth into the world, just as HBS was preparing them to do. And when they got there, they told me, they would remember the lessons learned here. They expected to be great bosses to the women who will work for them. When I think of opportunities 3, 10, 20 years out of HBS, Sam reflected, improving gender equality will be a huge part of making sure the women I've mentored will be able to succeed. The students seemed so sure of themselves. I wondered if their professors were as optimistic. So taking leave of the ambassadors, I headed toward the office of Robin Eli, a senior associate dean who runs the school's gender initiative. The initiative, created in 2015 as a center for research on female leadership, is Harvard's flag in the sand. It's a shout-out to the world that it is serious about closing the gender gap. If anyone could take the temperature of gender relations on campus, it would be Eli. A petite woman with spiky blonde hair and pink glasses, Eli ushered me into her office, comfortably crammed with overstuffed bookshelves, award plaques casually propped against paperbacks, and an unwieldy pile of papers obscuring her desk. A scholar of race and gender relations, she has studied everything from masculinity, by observing men on drilling rigs, to women's leadership programs. Her latest research was on the double bind women face. The more competent and powerful a woman is, the less she is liked. Eli herself is quite powerful, though it's been a long road to get there. When she first landed at Harvard Business School in 2000, she planned to teach a course on diversity. No one signed up. Students didn't want to talk about race and gender. They were at HBS to learn to be successful, to crush the competition, to win, not to take lessons in sensitivity training. Frustrated, Eli rethought her approach. She hit upon a new idea for a course. This time, she included some of the same material about diversity, but cloaked in a different guise. Her new class was about power and influence. It became an overnight sensation. "I'd throw in issues of race and gender," she said, laughing. Still, she had a hard time engaging students more deeply than that. They didn't see how getting ahead bore any relationship to diversity. Nobody was picking up on it or beating my door down like in other places, wanting to have these conversations, Eli said, recalling her frustration. "Why aren't we talking about this? I can't get anybody to bite in terms of the topic." "Since those early days, the atmosphere has really changed dramatically," Eli told me. "The steps HBS has taken have helped," she said. "The proportion of female students has grown, and a quarter of students are ethnic minorities. But there's more to it than that. Part of it is the zeitgeist. Clearly, the world was wanting to have a conversation." Even so, Harvard Business School's faculty still remains overwhelmingly male. Women make up only about a quarter of the school's professors. Female junior faculty often fare poorly, and turnover among them has been alarmingly high. A 2012 faculty climate survey found that male faculty members were far happier than their female counterparts. "Women have been so lacking in classrooms and case studies and academic leadership that in a 2015 meeting with female alums, Dean Nitin Noria apologized, saying women at times had been disrespected, left out, and unloved by the school. The school needed to walk the walk itself if it had any hope of trying to transform the culture for its students." A few years ago, Frances Fry, a senior associate dean, who has since joined Uber, dug into the dismal female faculty numbers herself. She found, to her consternation, that HBS was hiring men at twice the rate of women. What's more, it was promoting those men at twice the rate of the women, and making lateral hires of men from competing universities at 10 times the rate as for women. Drilling down behind the numbers, she found that one major problem was that women were disproportionately rejecting offers to join Harvard's faculty in the first place. Often they cited family issues, such as having a trailing spouse who needed to find a job in a new city, or having a young child and being unable to travel for research. The unequal rate of promotions was perhaps even more troubling. At first, Fry suspected unconscious bias against women, but her analysis revealed a surprise. The male scholars were publishing more frequently than the women, with more citations of their work, making them objectively more qualified for promotions. In an environment where our sport is writing, as she pointed out, if you don't write, you don't win. The men were simply better qualified than the women. "On the one hand, I was like, F," she said of her findings. "On the other hand, I was deeply relieved. I was like, let's ask the question, why are men more prepared than women?" What she found was that the men were no smarter or better prepared than the women, but they were far more confident when it came to submitting papers. Women kept trying to make their work better. They never felt it was quite good enough. The men suffered no such illusions. When they submitted papers, the men welcomed the feedback and review process as a way to improve their work. Not so the women. If their papers weren't perfect, they felt they were being a burden. You wouldn't think any faculty members at HBS would suffer from a lack of confidence. The place holds itself in such high regard that it borders on, some would say, crosses the line into arrogance. Yet Frey's finding at HBS reflect what researchers have discovered about women everywhere else. Numerous studies have concluded that men are overconfident about their own abilities, while women are underconfident about theirs. A study of trial lawyers, for example, found that female lawyers are less satisfied than male lawyers with their arguments to juries, regardless of results. In academia, that tendency is even more pronounced. Academic citations are considered an important measure of influence, but a recent study found that men frequently cite themselves. By pumping up the number of citations, they create the illusion of widespread recognition and increase their perceived level of authority and influence. That translates directly into professional recognition and rewards. The tactic has grown over the last two decades, with men citing themselves 70% more frequently than do women. Meanwhile, if a paper is rejected, it hits women far harder than men. Researchers have found that women, even those who have made it to the pinnacle of academic success at HBS, need more outside affirmation of their value than men do. KPMG commissioned a study of more than 3,000 professional women and college-age women. It found that when it came to self-esteem and a woman's estimation of how she was performing, a boss's praise is more meaningful than even a raise or a promotion. Lack of praise, or worse, rejection, can be professionally devastating. And as journalists Katty Kay and Claire Shipman noted in their book, The Confidence Code, confidence is more important than ability when it comes to getting ahead. That's exactly what was happening at HBS. Women were such perfectionists that they wouldn't send their papers out, Fry said. Or if they got a little bit of bad news, they faded away. So now, HBS leaders are on the lookout for the syndrome. They jump in early to encourage female academics to publish. The school also installed video cameras in the back of classrooms so that professors could review their teaching and catch their own misfires, annoying tics or a boring stretch when they lost the room, and learn how to make improvements. Ironically, though, the videotape ended up helping male professors while hurting female professors. For the women, it made them that much more self-conscious, Fry said. It derails her teaching. It turns out it's a terrible idea for many women. It made it worse. I can relate. I once was asked to substitute as an anchor for a cable television news program. In advance, network trainers taught me to read a teleprompter, videotaping the session so I could review them before I went on air. A male friend was also asked to substitute and given the same training. He spent an entire week scrutinizing and deconstructing his tapes. Meanwhile, I couldn't bear to look at mine. I still haven't. You can guess who performed better on live TV. HBS also provides one-on-one coaching for professors who need to improve their classroom performance, but that too sometimes has the reverse effect. In the business school's cafeteria, a haven of paneled walls and honeyed wooden tables, I sat down with Meg Reithmeyer, one of the most popular young professors at HBS. With shoulder-length blonde hair and wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a slouchy sweater, she could easily be mistaken for a student. A specialist in the Chinese economy, she was an acknowledged star among the older professors with whom I spoke. As we chatted, she munched on an apple and explained that she was putting the finishing touches on a book. She had just returned from a research trip to Asia, which HBS had helped make possible by arranging for her husband and baby to travel with her. But she also was highly aware of her female peers, who hadn't had the same degree of immediate success, and she noted that even if they recover after a rough start, it's hard for women to overcome that first impression. I have friends who did poorly the first year, then phenomenally, she said. But in the eyes of their department, they're still not a player. That, too, is true for the rest of the world. Women's mistakes are noticed more and remembered longer than those of men. Another issue for female faculty, she noted, is that women are expected to mentor other women, whether or not their skill sets, teaching styles, or academic specialties line up, which in turn takes time away from research and publishing. I don't have the time to be a mentor to every woman in the office, she said. There's a weird thing. There's a lot of discussion about mentorship. When I was in grad school, there was a movement to have every woman have a woman mentor, she added. I thought that was hilarious. Why? You should have a professional mentor. Reithmeyer is critical of the lean-in movement, which encourages women to support one another. It's done more harm than good, Reithmeyer said. The expectation is women have to take care of one another, and meanwhile, my male colleague is publishing articles. The time that women spend mentoring other women or sitting on multiple departmental panels because there are so few women to choose from hurts them professionally by taking precious hours away from their core jobs, in her view, in finance, academia, business, law, or being judged on our productivity during our reproductive years, she said as we rose to leave. It isn't going to be solved by a bunch of women leaning in. Reithmeyer echoed a frustration I've heard from other women in a variety of industries. Senior women are so scarce that they are often tapped to sit on every committee, to represent their organizations at conferences, to be the public face for recruiting, and to mentor other women, all of which prevents these women from actually doing their jobs. That, in turn, points up how essential it is to include men if we are to equalize the workplace. Men can be mentors as well as women, and men can advocate just as forcefully for equality. Women simply can't do it all on their own. By putting the burden on the very few of them to be the symbol and the savior of all women, we can unwittingly set them on a path to failure. On the train back from Cambridge, I reflected on those conversations. The school had succeeded somewhat in leveling the gender playing field, but ultimately, is Harvard Business School's approach working? Perhaps HBS's recent graduates, those who have been fully indoctrinated into its gender-leveling approach, could provide some answers. And so back to New York City I went, in search of graduates from the class of 2013, the one so vividly profiled in the Times. I soon found my way to Jennifer Brouse. Trained as an engineer, Brouse was an All-American soccer player in college and one of the few among her female Harvard classmates to choose a career in finance. In a class already made up of stars, Brouse was a standout. After graduation, she was one of the few students in her class and the only woman to attract a financial investment from two professors who backed her to start a highly competitive search fund, a pool of money with which to identify and acquire companies. Search funds are the shiniest, most prestigious brass rings a grad can grab. Simply attracting funding means your backers have rock-solid confidence in you. It's the fastest way to run your own business as an owner and chief executive officer. She and her husband promptly moved to Seattle, where she began searching for a business to buy. As far as she was concerned, Harvard did a pretty good job at maintaining gender equality while she was there. I never felt disrespected and felt that everyone was very professional and my professors were excellent. But the real world has been a different story. Running a search fund means dealing with business brokers, intermediaries who represent companies that are for sale, and the brokers, almost all of them men, have sometimes left her speechless with their comments. One guy asked me if my husband knew what I'm doing, she told me. Others assumed her husband was in charge, asking in surprise, "You are going to run the business?" When they learned that yes, she was, they'd ask, "What's your husband going to do?" I say, "Look, you don't ask that for anyone else. Why is everyone so concerned about my husband?" She added, "I've asked my male peers and never once was anyone asked if their wife is going to help run the business." Then there's Kunal Moody, who was class co-president back then. As a student, he had written the Huffington Post piece urging men to man up and participate in the fight for gender equality at work, at home, and at the ballot box. As he wrote at the time, men just as equally as women must take ownership of these family issues, which are core to American economic competitiveness. After graduation, he became a management consultant. He told me the school's focus on gender equality did indeed stick with him. Men need to do more to step up. Men have a real stake in this personally. We won't be the type of husbands and fathers we want to be if we aren't cognizant of these issues. Still, as hard as he has tried to hold on to those ideals, reality keeps getting in the way. Sometimes he notices the unintentional slight, the woman being cut off in conversation or her ideas credited to a man. But it's tricky when you're the new guy, not the boss. It's hard for a junior woman or man at work to say to a senior executive, "That thing you said is boneheaded." Moody remains hopeful, he told me. But he sees how much work remains to be done. By his estimate, 10% of guys are totally on board and supportive. 10% of guys are going to be Neanderthals and boneheaded. We've got to figure out the 80% of guys in the middle, who generally are for creating equal environments, where talent rises to the top. How do we reach them and help them understand that the status quo is a biased one? I'm reminded of something Frances Fry had told me earlier. There's still sometimes a disconnect, she said, between the bubble of Harvard Business School and the world outside its walls. She admitted some students are jolted when they leave HBS with the best of intentions and come smack face to face with reality. How dare you make it such a great cocoon? Some former students scolded her. You didn't prepare us for the harshness of the world. It's an almost impossible conundrum. Harvard Business School is relentlessly focused on its stated goal of creating the leaders of tomorrow. What it isn't focused on is the more immediate issue, creating the junior employees of today. How do you expect your students to change the world when they aren't in charge? How do they empower others when they have no power themselves? The realization hit me. Harvard and other schools need to prepare not just for leadership down the road, but for how to navigate and change the real world right now. As, dare I say it, junior staffers, it has yet to crack that code. Fry was sure HBS was on the right path. She was certain she saw a change in her male students that would last beyond graduation. Oh, yes, she said emphatically when I asked whether the lessons of HBS will stick. I'm a crazy optimist, but I do believe in 10 years gender won't be the obstacle to meritocracy that we're obsessed with now. Something else will take its place. The reason I'm optimistic, she added, is I see the millennials. They are different than any group I've ever seen. Gender doesn't occur to them. They aren't self-conscious about gender in a way that every other class was conscious of their gender. They're conscious about many other things, but gender doesn't seem nearly as high on their list. I'd like to believe that these men and the younger men coming along behind them will bring about meaningful change. At the same time, the evidence so far suggests that millennial men's youthful idealism will fade with age and responsibility. The forces of the culture we live in are powerful and difficult for a single generation to transform. As these young men grow older, marry, have children, and take on mortgages, their attitudes change. A study by the Families and Work Institute found that just a third of millennial men without kids think they should be primary breadwinners. But that figure spikes to 53% for those who have kids, and a study published in American Sociological Review found that while both young men and women have egalitarian views, they change their attitudes when faced with inflexible workplaces and lack of family-friendly policies. At Harvard Business School, male grads so far have trod an exceedingly traditional path. A 2014 survey found that half of its male millennial grads still expect their careers will take priority over that of their wives. What's more, two-thirds assume their wives will deal with the kids, taking on the majority of childcare. Yet only a minority of their female classmates agree with either of those assumptions, a potentially explosive landmine for both men and women down the road as they marry and have children. I saw an inkling of that gender divide while on campus. The investment clubs were still almost all male. Few female HBS grads end up in the lucrative and prestigious world of venture capital, and the business leaders who visit the campus only reinforce the gap. One new grad told me about the finance executive who came to lecture his class and told them point blank that if you're a woman and you want to have a baby, it will be hard to be a banker at this bank. The HBS class of 2013 that Cantor wrote about in The Times is now well on their way toward the leadership roles the school groomed them to obtain. Brooke Boyarsky, who was one of the year's standout students, a George F. Baker scholar awarded to the top 5% of students in the class and chosen by her peers to speak at graduation week, went on to become a consultant at McKinsey. Looking back on her time at HBS, she is philosophical about how lasting the emphasis on gender will be. The group of people who would have been passionate about these issues have gone on to be more passionate, and many are men, she told me. I can say my male friends at HBS, who I now work with, they have been huge supporters. The men have stayed involved, which is a good sign. But she is realistic. HBS isn't a miracle. I don't know that it made everyone a warrior for women. Her words got me thinking back to the Mambassadors. With the club now fully established, I wondered how its original founders were faring. Surely they'd still be activists. After all, they were the most vocal students, the ones who led the way in the pursuit of gender equality. So I searched out Tara Hagen, whose conversation with a perplexed male friend helped spark the club that sparked a movement. After her 2014 graduation, Hagen had joined a large advertising agency. When we spoke a year later, she told me her male boss was terrific. Of course, there were times when he used male pronouns by default, as if assuming everyone of importance is a man, but she didn't feel it was her place to point that out. At HBS, it's about making you better leaders, so being inclusive makes you a better leader, she said. But if I'm in advertising, I can't necessarily say that understanding diversity is going to make a better ad product. It's harder to tie in. I can't say, let's use female pronouns because that will win us an award. And what of her activism on behalf of gender issues? In HBS, it's cool to brand yourself as a feminist, she said. At work, I'm pretty sure women are feminists, but I feel like I shouldn't broadcast it because it could be off-putting to my coworkers. Then she told me something that left me wide-eyed with surprise. I don't even tell my coworkers I did Mambassadors because it's so weird. She confessed, part of me is torn. With all this experience at HBS, I should go into the corporate world and bring along that sensitivity to gender issues, but it's kind of intimidating. The corporate pecking order simply doesn't lend itself to the kind of conversations fostered at HBS. At school, you're all peers. There's no set hierarchy, she explained. Whereas, in a corporate structure, you're new on the job, and you can't really change a culture of corporation. It's tougher in the workplace. Millennials and their younger siblings may yet change the dynamics between women and men. But as Hagen and her colleagues have already found, it will take hard work. Despite the best efforts of Harvard Business School, the future business leaders of tomorrow are still running splat into the brick wall of institutional sexism of today. To effect real change, these young men and women will need to shed the bad habits of their elders and stay focused on breaking the cycle of unequal pay, promotions, and respect. They will need to work together to keep pushing for family-friendly policies and to fight for equality at work and at home. For her part, Tara Hagen is still trying to do just that. 2 years after our first conversation, I checked in with her again to ask if workplace culture progressed. Not so much, she admitted. It's just insanely hard to get real change and improvement at the top. Yet she also told me about strategies she has devised that are making a difference. She works with simpatico clients who feel as strongly as she does about diversity. She uses humor to diffuse sexist behavior, and she's already mentoring the next generation. That's what gives her hope for the future. I have a handful of awesome women on my teams, she told me, that I'm grooming, that I see growing. They're awesome.